not.
Katie scrunched her legs around behind his seat, trying to encourage blood flow. The bracelet was a weight on her wrist. It seemed like she could hear the tag shimmer every time she so much as took a breath. The sound made her as conscious of every tiny motion as if a predator watched her.
How much longer?
Homer pulled the car onto a narrow road that wound through a heavy copse of trees. An ivy-covered sign, unreadable, made Katie think this must be the remains of an abandoned office park. Somebody had laid truckloads of gravel over the ruined asphalt, so the driveway was smoother than the municipal road that led to it.
"To see your lawnmower," he said.
Like industrialization and the black satanic mills, globalization is a failed model that nevertheless we have to pass through to invent the next modality. Even holding the car door for Katie, Shearer was still lecturing. And Katie was still listening, though she was starting to find some intelligent questions.
"So who makes the stuff you can't salvage?" she asked.
"The stuff you hold in common? Does your society work without an industrial society to parasitize?" Shearer grinned. "Maybe not. But industrial society has it coming. Alley-oop." Propped on the open door, she offered Katie a hand, and Katie, despite her better judgment regarding Shearer's frailty, accepted it. She tried to use the frame of the auto as her primary source of lift for standing, but the older woman's strength surprised her. In reflected light, Katie could see where parking lots had once been. Now the rustle of tall corn filled the night. Here, there were people. Men and women moved along pathways lit by solar-powered LED lamps stuck on spikes into the grass, so Katie had very little sense of their faces, forms, or how they were dressed. But she heard the click of high heels and the rubbery thud of heavy boots, the scuff of sneakers, and the light, high Tinkerbell shimmer of tags ringing on each other as their wearers moved. Everyone seemed casually busy, and a few were far more intent, obviously in a hurry. But some passers-by still glanced at Katie and her escorts, and several greeted Shearer and Homer with a word or a wave. Katie found herself hiding half behind Homer, sticking close to his heels like an uncertain dog or a child.
"I'm gonna let Homer take you around," Shearer said. "My hip has had enough."
Homer studied her with a concerned expression, but his only response was a nod.
"I'll meet you in the lounge."
Shearer winked before she turned away.
"Make sure you take her up to the roof."
Inside, they paused in a glass-roofed atrium full of potted, chest-tall fruit trees. The heavy scent of oranges filled the air, sharp enough to wrinkle Katie's nose. The space was not brightly lit. Instead, strands of fairy light LEDs strung overhead gave illumination enough to walk by. And as with outside, there were people walking. A woman in blue jeans and a flannel shirt with the sleeves rolled up tended the orange and lime trees, dropping fruit into a basket that curved around her hip. A man surrounded by 6 or 7 school-aged children climbed the wide stair to the mezzanine level, and a security guard, or receptionist, or both, looked up from behind the desk beside the doors. Her entire head and body, except her face, was enveloped in a hijab and chador. But based on her gimlet-eyed appraisal of them as they entered, Katie did not think the concealing garments would slow her down at all. After her inspection, she nodded, though Katie caught her rechecking Katie's wrist for the bracelet before she looked down. When Katie stuffed her hand into her pocket, the tag caught on fabric, keeping her from reaching easily to the bottom. She was still following Homer like a duckling, head down so her dreads hid her expression. But she had to steal glances at the flock of children climbing the stairs, and Homer caught her. She imagined Firouza laughing with these children, flocking with them like so many noisy starlings. Her own childhood had been playgroups and educational trips and team sports in the summertime, and she wondered what it was like to grow up surrounded by foster siblings. Did their caretakers watch them? Make sure nobody got bullied? That the little ones got their fair share? Everybody in San Diego must think she was dead by now. She wondered what they had done when the emails and phone calls had stopped coming. Had they worried? Had her sister said to her mother, "Mama, I told her so."
"You did. You did, Ruby. You did."
"You have your own crush?" she asked, as they reached the bottom of the flight themselves. The kids in their minder vanished through a door at the top of the stairs.
"School," he said. "Not crush. They stay with their guardians at night."
"Guardians or parents," he amended.
"They're probably on their way home now. Distributed model also makes child rearing that much easier."
She watched his shoulders rise and fall, and suffered a realization. "You have kids."
"Had."
He paused at the top of the stair and waited, looking down at her until she caught him.
"You'll discover that a lot of people find us out of some kind of life trauma."
"Oh," she said. "I'm sorry." This time, the shrug came with widespread hands. He looked at her, really looked at her, and she looked back just as hard. What she saw was a skinny, sallow-skinned person with acne scars across the tops of his cheeks. One who didn't look down when she stared right at him. "It's about people, too," she realized. "You can't do what they want to do without people." And then, like a tripping cat, the realization, "I'm people."
"It is what it is,"
Homer said.
"Come on."
A bank of elevators waited silently immediately before them, but two had the buttons taped over, and the third bore a hand-lettered sign that read, "Are you sure?" Katie found the implied faith in personal judgment refreshing and was about to say so to Homer, but he was already vanishing up a stair. He paused just inside to hold the door for her, and she ran a couple of steps to catch up.
"Farther up and further in," she said. But Homer looked at her blankly.
"Never mind," she finished with a wince. He didn't seem concerned about it anyway. He led her up three flights at a trot that made her glad of the time she spent in a bicycle saddle, and then out into a corridor that connected on either end to a broad open space broken up by partial height walls.
"A cube farm?"
Katie asked.
"Former cube farm,"
he said, and led her out into the walkways between the once beige fabric walls.
Somebody with little concern for corporate image had been at them with fabric paints and glitter glue, illuminating the cubes with vivid, primitive paintings of macaws and monkeys, sea turtles and sloths. Even in the LED fairy light, the colors were stunning enough that Katie wished she was seeing them by daylight.
Curtains, repurposed blankets, draperies, and shower curtains, hung across the doorway of each cube. And from inside some of them, Katie could hear the click of keypads or the rustle of cloth. One or two stood open, empty, revealing futon mattresses with neatly folded bedclothes, plastic crates set beside them to serve as storage, and tables.
"Dormitories," she said.
Homer cocked his finger like a gun and made an approving click.
"Yours if you want to use them. First come, first served. Though it becomes possible to make reservations with enough history of service. But as you can see, we're rarely full."
There were plants here, too, racked in front of the floor-to-ceiling windows where they would break up the glare of the light. Katie recognized potted strawberries, thyme, basil, rosemary, and sage.
"Clover?"
she asked, pointing. "What for?"
Homer followed her line. "Wood sorrel," he said. "Grows like a weed, and it's tasty and full of vitamin C. We toss it in soup. Might as well. Here, follow me."
He led her to another stair,
this one in the corner of the building and boasting an old fire exit sign. Again, she climbed behind him, this time hearing the giggles of children echoing down the glass and cement stairwell. She was not sure if she wanted to catch them, or if what she really wanted was to clap her hands over her ears and block the sound away. Whatever her conscious mind thought, her subconscious was sure. She only caught herself walking faster when she almost trod on Homer's heels. "The person who painted the murals," she said when Homer turned back to see what the rush was. "Did she... he... earn more tags for doing that?"
"Not just for that," Homer said. "She's kind of a polymath. But yes, that's one of her contributions."
"Okay," Katie said. "So really, it's not all that different from anything else. Except instead of money, you get tags."
"Except instead of contributing to an exploitative economy designed to line the pockets of the top capital holders, we're contributing to a collective economy in which people know one another by reputation."
"Until it gets too big."
"Then we split up," Homer said. "Subdivide until we reach a sustainable level. Growth, getting as big as possible as fast as possible, is not the only way to survive. Think about dinosaurs and mammals." His grin was infectious. He pushed open the roof door and she followed him, surprised by the springiness of turf under her feet and the sweetness of cool night air. She had, perhaps subconsciously, been expecting gravel and the reek of rubber roofing after a long day baking in the sun.
"Green roof," she said, an exclamation of surprise, and felt Homer's smug pleasure beside her.
"This is all ancient technology," he said. "From turf roofs to cooperative agriculture. It's just that for a while we got confused about progress and hooked on the idea that it also means giving up what works."
As they moved out into the darkness and Katie's eyes adjusted, she could make out the silhouettes of other people. First, the children she'd glimpsed earlier. Not giggling and shoving now, but standing in a close and cheerful huddle, gathered around something illuminated by the LED flashlight in their crouching instructor's hand. Beyond them, a couple pulled each other close, watching the crescent moon rise over trees. The taller man's head leaned on top of his lover's. Katie stepped away from Homer, towards the huddle of children gathered around the puddle of bright green light. The instructor glanced up as she came close, registering her approach, but didn't otherwise acknowledge her. Since he also made no move to exclude her, she rose up on tiptoe to see over the heads of the kids. They were gathered around an unprepossessing black beetle the size of a kidney bean, and as Katie was wondering what exactly the point of the exercise was, the instructor took his thumb off the button on the LED flash and the light went out. Her eyes took a moment to adjust to blackness and moonlight. The silver-limbed figures of the hunched-over children and the high block wall of the roof edge beyond. Moonlight, she remembered from somewhere, is comprised of parallel rays because it is reflected as if by a giant mirror. It's cold. Reflected light is cold. And it casts perfect, sharp-edged shadows because it does not scatter the way sunlight does. It turned each blade of grass into a slender knife of frost, and the pools of shadow under the children into bottomless wells. Twinkling green fairy lights flickered on and off overhead, casting no appreciable illumination, unlike the LED chains in the lobby. That's what Katie thought, at least, until at the center of their gathering, a sharp signal flickered, cold chemical light, as green as the doused LED answering the flashes overhead. "Firefly," she breathed, understanding, and bit her lip just in time to keep from embarrassing herself by saying it out loud.
"The female stays on the ground," the instructor said, "until she finds a male that flashes fast and bright enough to interest her. When that happens, she flashes back to show him where to find her. Until she does that, the male doesn't even know she's there."
"Then why don't all the bad flashes get bred out?"
It was a girl who asked the question, Katie thought,
but was hard to tell from the voices in the dark. She wondered if Firuza had ever seen a firefly.
That's a really good question, Sabrina. See, there are other males who aren't such good flashers, and sometimes they wait until a female flashes at a male who is bright, and then they try to get to her first and fool her. So they can pass on their genes by being tricky. Salazar, here, pick out a male, one of the flying ones. Take the LED and see if you can imitate the flashes well enough to get him to come down to you.
In the intermittent back glow of the LED, Katie could make out Salazar's face. He might have been 8 or 9 years old, and as he looked up, his expression was as perfectly intent as any scientist's as he tried to pick one male firefly's flash pattern out of the holding pattern overhead. Katie only realized she was holding her breath when Salazar's silent concentration imploded around the sudden, unmistakable, hail-pelting rattle of gunfire.
She hit the ground, or roof, intuitively sweeping Salazar and one of the other children into her arms and covering them with her body. Homer hit the turf beside her as the instructor began snapping orders to his charges, quick commands that spoke of faithful drill. As they all dropped to a crouch and began moving quickly and in good order towards the roof door, Katie rolled to let the children she'd shielded scramble alongside their classmates. At the edge, the two men who had been watching the moonrise both went to their knees, peering over the wall like archers over a battlement. One, the shorter one, touched his headset. Katie saw the blue light flicker live as he began to speak into it. Homer touched her arm.
Follow the kids. Ernie will take care of you.
Homer, this might be about me.
Miss Grange,
he said,
not everything is about you. Go with the nice man.
Katie thought about arguing, but Homer was already moving away from her while Ernie must be the instructor, shooed 8-year-olds down the stairs single file, counting each child with a tap on the head as he or she passed. Katie, bent double with her knees against her chest, ran to meet him.
Homer says you'll take care of me, she said,
when Ernie looked at her with elevated eyebrows. He doused the light inside the stairwell, but she could see his expression plainly by moonlight. She bit her lip and said,
sorry, I'm new.
It was the first real notion she'd had that Homer and Shearer's hard sell was working. Ernie studied her for a second, dark, thick hair falling in a wing across his forehead until he shook it back irritably.
Right, he said. Sorry. Didn't mean to be an asshole. Come with me.
Down the stairs in the dark, without even the light of the LED flashlights to guide them. Only one floor, because the stairwell was at the corner of the building, and they would have been visible and vulnerable through the glass if anyone had cared to look up. The children stayed close to the center of the staircase, heads ducked, shoulders hunched as they crabbed down the flight. Katie mimicked them, protecting the ones closest to her with her body as much as she could. The descent gave her a strobe image series of glimpses of the firefight below. Muzzle flash and then a shuddering roar of water as defenders within and atop the besieged office building opened up with fire hoses. Searchlights flooded the lawn and crop fields with light. Rows of corn shook with the passage of running bodies, like something out of a horror movie. A child at the front of the file pressed her tags to a control panel by the door on the landing, and it slid open with a whisper of complaint. The kids ducked through, Ernie pausing to usher Katie through, and then he sealed the door behind. Once the solid door was shut, the kids straightened up. Katie tried to emulate them, fighting a contraction of her abdominal muscles as if someone had fastened her lower ribs to her pelvis with giant hog-nosed staples. By placing one hand on the wall and pushing against it, she managed to stand up tall, though she thought Ernie and all the kids could see her shoulders and knees shaking. With a wink, and slapped her on the shoulder.
Come on! The panic room's not far. Come on, kids, look sharp!
Doors had closed across the corridors like airlocks, breaking each one into defensible segments, and Ernie opened each one with his tag and cleared the other side like a pro before he let them pass each one. He urged them into a trot,
using his voice like a border collie's bark to keep them both moving and close. Katie was pretty sure herding children wasn't supposed to be that easy. Given the circumstances, she was happy to be herded as well. It's easy to give up authority in crisis. Easy to do what you're told. Easy to follow orders and let someone else take responsibility. Easy to pretend you didn't know what was going on. It's not the same thing as trust, but it's like trust. She reached into her pocket and palmed her butterfly knife, right-handed, slipped the pepper spray into the left, caught the glance across the children's head that told her Ernie had seen her do it, and nodded agreement when the quick jerk of his head sent her up to the front of the line. She flipped the knife open, hiding it from the kids with her body. Motion made her tag ring on her bracelet with a clear, sharp chime.
"Open the door," Ernie said when they came to the next lock.
Katie brushed her tag against it and pushed it open with her shoulder, telling herself to be ready for whatever was on the other side. Nothing. The sharp beat of her heart left the taste of rotting metal in her mouth as she turned left, then right, and made doubly sure. Her pulse ratcheted down a half notch, and she was just about to slink forward and clear the offices, opening off both sides, when the door to the nearer one flipped back, and she found herself face to face with a man with a gun. She reacted almost without knowing it, taking in so many details in an instant. The stubble on his cheek, the way his gun shook in his hand. It was just adrenaline. She didn't think for a moment that he would hesitate to shoot her. Her left hand came up and she maced him in the face. His gun went off. The head-spinning boom almost blinded her. But he'd flinched, and the first bullet must have missed her, because she didn't feel it hit. She stepped forward, the knife rising from her fist like a scorpion's sting, and punched him under the ribs. Hard. Something shoving her hand down. Thunder against the side of her head, a blow as if somebody had struck her on the ear with a cymbal. Hot air kicked against her cheek as the gun fired again and he staggered into her. The knife driving down her fist because he leaned against it. And how was she on her knees? How had that happened? He slumped on top of her, everything slippery and wet, his shirt tearing away from the knife blade so she could see the dark ink of the tattoos across his chest. Should his skin be that white under the red? Maybe all the blood was on the outside now. She fell under his weight, hard thump as her head hit the floor. Her strength all swirled out of her like somebody had pulled a cork on a string. She woke briefly at the bounce of the gurney as paramedics lifted her into place. Woke again as they slid the trolley into the elevator. "Are you sure?" Katie thought, unironically, and felt herself going under, swept along a tumble of semi-consciousness and battered on its rocks. "I need my daughter sent them," she said, or tried to say, but there was something over her nose and mouth, and the paramedics looked at her as uncomprehendingly as farm animals. She would have panicked. She tried to panic, but even the adrenaline could not keep her above water when the tide of exhaustion swept over her again. The next awakening was gentler, gray, soft, in cool sheets. Someone beside her, because Katie could hear the breathing. She turned her head and opened her eyes and found herself face to face with Stephanie Shearer. The rustle of sheets must have alerted Shearer, because she looked up from her Omni, opened flat in reader mode, and smiled. "Awake pretty fast," she said, and folded the Omni away. Katie made a noise that she meant to be a word, but it came out as more of a wheeze.
"Sorry," said Shearer. "I can't give you a drink. The bullet perforated your intestine. But it's all fixed now, and you can have a swab. Will that help?"
Helplessly, Katie nodded. She managed to raise a hand to take the soaked sponge on a stick that Shearer handed her. There wasn't enough water in it, but it did ease the stickiness on her tongue and palate. A few moments later, she managed to croak.
"What happened?"
Shearer took the swab away.
You got shot, and then managed to knife the shooter fatally. Don't worry. We have very good lawyers. You're unlikely to be charged. Firuza, Katie said. She tried to make it sound like a question, but she couldn't get her voice to lift at the end.
Safe in the Cascades. We have a place there.
Shearer smiled, dunking the swab in the water glass again.
Distributed living. You can go see her as soon as you're well enough. I mean, assuming you want to stay with us.
Katie wasn't ready to think about that yet. So she said,
You were the artist.
Artist?
On the cubicles. Her voice was coming back. You painted the cubicles in the dormitory.
Busted, Shearer said, smiling. You saw me coming. I thought they needed something to make them feel like home.
She rummaged in her pocket, came up with something, and laid it on the bedside table with a soft chime. Katie lifted her head to look, aware now of the tug of needles in her left hand. It was the circular bracelet, and now, she saw, there were three tags on it. Is that mine?
Can't keep you on probation when you've gotten shot defending us, Shearer said. What do you say?
Your people in Ukraine. You still need help? Shearer nodded. So did Katie, though it made her head spin. All right. Then she pressed her head back into the pillow and closed her eyes against the dizziness. I'll do it. You know the thing about your utopia. She didn't open her eyes to look at Shearer, but she felt the tension, heard the creak of her chair as she leaned forward. Shearer said,
It's not a utopia. It's just maybe something that sucks a little less. And it's not mine.
Yeah, Katie said. Whatever. It took a minute for her to gather her strength. This will never work. A longer silence this time. Until Shearer said,
It's hope. Even if it fails, it's hope. We need hope. We need to learn to trust the people we ought to trust again.
Yeah. Katie swallowed. Her throat still ached with dryness. She wondered if she had enough strength to ask for the swab again. I can't argue with that.
And now we come to my story. And to explain my story, I need to expand a little on what I saw my role as during the creation of Metatropolis. First off, I was editor of the project, which meant that in the early stages I needed to help direct the world-building conversations and move them toward a workable plan. Later, when the stories came in, I gave feedback to the other authors about what needed to be tweaked in their stories. The good news, in both cases, was that I was working with really smart, really talented, and experienced writers and creators. So in that respect, my responsibilities were very easy and very simple. But I was also an author here as well as an editor. And the editor in me decreed that the author in me would be the spackle of the anthology. What that means is that if after all the stories were in, there was some aspect of this shared world still left unexplored, then I would need to go in and cover that hole. And as it turned out, there was indeed one small hole. The stories of Metatropolis were indeed meta. That is, they looked beyond cities in really interesting and fascinating ways. However, that meant to me that there needed to be a story actually situated inside of a city, from the point of view of someone for whom the cities were simply home. So that's the story I assigned to myself. And because I'm dumb, I gave it a title in Latin that I can barely pronounce. Nevertheless, I am proud to present to you Uteri Nihil Non Extra Quiritationum Suis, read by Alessandro Giuliani.
When people look at my wedding photos, they often wonder what the pig is doing in the wedding party. Well, let me tell you. It all began, like so many things do, on a Monday. The first thing I remember is my little sister Cindy poking me in the cheek. "Mom says it's time to get up," she said. I swatted at her with my eyes closed. "It's too early to get up," I said. "It's 9:30, Cindy said. It says so right on your alarm clock." "The clock lies," I said. Cindy started poking me in the face again. "Mom told me to tell you if you missed your placement appointment that she would make you regret it." "I'll be up in a minute," I said, and then rolled over and tried to go back to sleep. I could hear Cindy stomp off, calling for Mom. A couple minutes later, I heard someone come back in the room. "Benjamin," said a lower voice than my sister's. It was Mom. "You have your placement appointment in an hour. Time to get up."
"I'm up," I said.
"There is no definition of up that includes lying in bed with your eyes closed," Mom said.
5 more minutes," I said. "I swear I'll be up then."
"Oh, I know you will be," Mom said, and that's when she poured a pitcher of water onto my head. I tried to jump out of bed and got tangled in my blankets and fell headfirst onto the rug.
"That's better," Mom said.
I rubbed my head. "That wasn't necessary," I told her.
"No," she agreed. "I could have poured hot coffee in your lap instead, but either way, you're out of bed. Now you get into the shower. You have 5 minutes for that. After that, I switch the shower over to gray water, and I know how much you hate that."
I pulled myself off the floor and stomped over to the bathroom. Mom was right. Gray water sucked. Technically, it was filtered to be just as clean as regular water. Psychologically, I didn't want to bathe in water one filtering process away from someone's kidneys.
5 minutes, Mom said, and don't think I'm not paying attention. You're not going to miss this appointment, Benji.
I'm not going to miss it, I said, starting the water.
I know, Mom said, because I'll drag you there by the hair if I have to.
She walked off. As she walked off, I saw Cindy smirking at me.
Should have got up when I said to, she said.
Piss off, I said. She smirked some more and flounced off. I stripped out of my underwear and stepped into the shower and stayed in it until that sulfur smell told me Mom had switched the tank over to gray water. Then I soaped up, rinsed off, and got out. 10 minutes later, I was standing on the curb, waiting for at least one other person to come out of the complex and rideshare. You can take a pod by yourself if you have to, but it comes out of your overall household energy budget, and we were already splurging on the standard water for showering. If I soloed a pod to my appointment, Mom really would drop hot coffee into my lap. So I stood there for a few minutes, waiting to see who would come by.
"Hey, look," someone said behind me, stepping into the pod queue. "If it isn't Benji."
I turned and saw Will Rosen, one of my least favorite humans, and Leah Benson, who was one of my favorites. Sadly, Leah and Will were a couple, so spending time with Leah meant having to tolerate Will, and him having to tolerate me. So I didn't see Leah all that much.
"Hello, Benji," Leah said.
"Hi, Lee," I said, and smiled, and then glanced over next to her.
"Will," I said.
"You're up early," Will said. "It's not even noon."
On cue, a pod swung up on the track and opened the door to let us in. I considered telling them I was waiting for Cindy and taking the next pod.
"Coming, Benji?" Leah said.
I climbed in.
"Parker Tower," Will said to the destination panel. He was off to work.
"Kent Tower,"
Leah said. She was off to work, too.
"City Administration," I said.
"Running an errand for your mom?"
Will said as we started moving.
"No," I said more defensively than I intended.
"I've got a placement appointment."
Will feigned a heart attack.
"I don't believe it," he said. "That means you actually took your aptitudes?"
"Yeah," I said, and looked out the window. I was trying to avoid this conversation.
"Miracles do happen," Will said.
"Will,"
Leah said.
"Benji knows I'm kidding,"
Will said, the same way he always did when he was doing some serious knife-twisting work.
"And anyway, I think it's great. He's the last of our class to do it. He always did things on his own schedule, but I was beginning to wonder how close he was planning to cut it."
"Now you know," I said.
"Well, congratulations," Will said. "It'll be nice to know you're part of the contributing part of society now. that you're not just relying on your mom to get you through? That was when I decided I'd had just about enough of Will. Thanks, Will, I said, and shifted position. So, how's your brother these days? Will got a look that I guessed you might get if you had something very cold and hard suddenly thrust up your ass. I treasured that look. He's fine, Will said, so far as I know. Really? I said. Oh, that's great. I always liked him. The next time you see him, you tell him I said hello. Leah shot me a look that said, stop that. I just smiled pleasantly as pie for the next couple of minutes until the pod slowed down, came to a stop, and then opened to let Will out. He was still sitting there, glaring at me. Your stop, I said. Will snapped out of it, gave Leah a quick kiss, and hustled himself out the door of the pod. That wasn't very nice, Leah said to me as we started moving again. Well, he asked for it, I said, and motioned back to the platform where Will had gotten off. Ah, you saw it. He was crapping all over me in that I'm just kidding, condescending way of his, like he always does. Oh, tell me he wasn't trying to push my buttons, like he always does. He was trying to push your buttons, Leah said, agreeing with me. But you don't do much to stop him, Benji. I think asking him about his brother stopped him pretty well, I said. There are better ways, Leah said. Are there? I asked. Leah, you know I love you dearly, but that guy you're dating is kind of an asshole. Why are you still with him? You mean why am I still with him and not you? Leah said. This crossed my mind, I said. I remember trying that, Leah said. I don't remember it working out very well. I was young and stupid, I said, and gave her a smile. I got over it, really. Leah smiled, which was something I liked to see, and looked out the pod window for a moment. Benji, you were always very cute, she said. But as much as you'd hate to admit it, Will has a point. You've been taking longer to grow up than the rest of us did. When the rest of us finished our studies, we took the aptitudes and got jobs. You spent your time sleeping in and screwing around. Will's right that you're the last one in our class to take your aptitudes and to get placement. That's not true, I said. There's Taylor White. Leah fixed me with a look. You're really going to compare yourself with a guy who was eating crayons until he was 15, she said. That's a rumor, I said. It's not a rumor, Leah said. I saw him do it. Art class. It was a green pastel. He nibbled it, Benji. Then he put it back. I had to share the pastel box with him. It was disgusting. Nibbling's not the same as eating, I said. Does it really matter, Leah said. Taylor's a sweet guy, but we both know he's going into the assisted job track. You don't have that excuse. You're 2 months off from being 20, Benji. That really is cutting it close. I don't know what that has to do with you going out with Will and not me, I said. We were coming into Leah's stop. I know, Benji, she said. That's sort of the problem. The door slid open. Leah reached over and kissed my cheek. Good luck today, Benji, she said. Thanks, I said. Leah slipped out of the pod. Hey, I said. She turned back to look at me. Even if you're not going to date me, you could still do better. Leah looked like she might say something to that, but the pod door slid shut. And so I landed in the office of Charmaine Lowe, public assignment officer for the city of New St. Louis. Ah, Mr. Washington, she said from her desk as I walked in. Behind her was a large monitor that took nearly the entire back wall of her office. Why don't you come in and have a seat? Thanks, I said, and admired the monitor. Lowe followed my gaze to the monitor and then looked back at me. It's a monitor, she said. I know, I said. It's nice. I need to get one of those for my bedroom. Not unless you have a special dispensation from the Energy Board, she said. She was looking down now at the tablet monitor that held my case file. I'll have to talk to my mom about that, I said, trying to make it sound like a joke. Lowe looked up at this with a look that told me I had failed badly.
Oh, that's right, she said. You're the son of Josephine Washington. Must be nice having your mother on the executive board of the city, Lowe said.
It's not too bad, I said.
I voted for your mother in the last election, Lowe said.
I'll tell her that when I get home, I said.
I hope you understand, Mr. Washington, that your mother's stature and influence won't help you here,
Lo said.
Job assignments in the city are based on merit, not nepotism.
I know, I said. Sorry about the monitor thing. I mean, I was trying to make a joke. Lo looked at me for a moment. I decided not to make any more jokes. Sorry, I said again.
Well then, let's get to it,
she said, and tapped her tablet. The wall monitor sprang to life with thousands of boxes, each with text in them. She pointed at the wall and looked back at me.
Do you know what this is?
She asked.
No, I said.
This is a representation of every single job that is available right now in New St. Louis, Lo said.
Everything from neurosurgeon right down to janitorial systems maintenance crew. Roughly about 1,000 jobs at the moment. This is a live feed, so you'll see some jobs disappear as they are filled and new ones show up as they come online.
I looked up again and took a closer look. She was right about it being a live feed. As I watched, one of the text boxes winked out of existence. Somewhere in New St. Louis, someone had a new job as a creche supervisor, watching bunches of hyperactive two-year-olds while their parents were off at their jobs.
As your mother has no doubt told you, New St. Louis has a managed employment economy, Lo said. Every adult who lives in NSL is required to work, and all vacancies are filled internally whenever possible. Each new entrant into the NSL workforce, whether through immigration or through graduation from the NSL school system, is required to take a series of aptitude tests that help us place that person into the initial job.
Right, I said, and remembered the aptitudes. How I hated them.
First off, they took 2 days out of your life after you've already gotten your education certificate. In other places, in other times, a high school diploma was all you needed for a job.
Not especially good jobs, my mom would point out, but even so.
But here in New St. Louis, all your education certificate meant was that you were allowed to take your aptitudes. So, 2 days. The first day was a recap of math, science, history, literature, and other school subjects, which to me seemed a waste of time these days. Yes, it's nice to remember all this stuff in your head, but the fact of the matter was, even if you didn't, everything you had to know about anything was a database search away, and had been for decades. And out in the real world, the chance that you would need to know when New St. Louis was founded, or the intricacies of the city's zero-footprint ecological and economic philosophy, and would not have a mini-terminal in your pocket, approached zero. You know, I think of myself as a practical person, and in practice, all this memorization just seemed like busy work to me. I know I can find out anything with a query. Worrying about stuffing my head seems a bit much. That said, I wasn't completely stupid. I did spend a little time reviewing the basics before my aptitudes. And because I didn't want to stress myself overly, I also made sure to have a good time the night before. I think that being relaxed is key. My mother might disagree. So might Leah. If the first day was annoying, the second day was just mystifying. A series of conversations with a rotating pack of NSL city workers about completely pointless subjects that really had nothing to do with anything as far as I could tell. Sometimes I didn't understand my hometown's job protocol. I notice you took your aptitudes at the last possible opportunity to do so, Lo said.
I'm sure a lot of people do it that way, I said.
No, not really, Lo said. Most kids do them right after their schooling is completed, so everything is still fresh in their heads. Most of them are also eager to start contributing to the well-being of NSL as soon as possible, and to start their career paths.
I shrugged. After I'd gotten my education certificate schooling, I decided to travel to some of the other cities that shared open borders with New St. Louis, the Portland Arcologies and other parts of Cascadia, the Malibu Enclave, Singapore and Hong Kong, and the new Helsinki Collective. They kept me busy for a few months, and in a good way, I thought. Travel broadens the mind and all that. Mom wasn't very happy about this, but I had promised her I'd take the aptitudes the next time they were offered once I got back. And I did try, but things kept getting in the way. I finally took them because I was coming up on my 20th birthday, and here in New St. Louis, they had a word for 20-year-olds who hadn't taken their aptitudes to get assigned a job. Evicted. Even new Louis who went to university outside the city had to take their aptitudes before the 20th. They took them remotely and had their scores filed away for later. Miss them, though, and out you go. That's what happened to Will's brother, Marcus. He missed his last chance to take the aptitudes 5 years ago, and the city showed up at the door with his document of removal, escorted him to the city border, placed a credit card worth 16 ounces of gold into his hands, and waved goodbye. Now Marcus was living outside, in the banged-up ring of suburbs around St. Louis, new and old, that we referred to as the Wilds, doing whatever the hell it was people in the Wilds did with their time. I suspected he was scrounging and gardening, not necessarily in that order. And now you know why Will would have been happy to stab me for mentioning his brother. Marcus could get back in one day. Maybe. People who'd been booted out of NSL for missing their aptitudes could get back in only once they'd taken a new set of tests and waited to see if there was a job that no one in the city wanted. And even then, they'd have to wait in line. Because the list went New Louis first, citizens of other open-border cities next, and then finally the rest of the world. You skip your last chance at the aptitudes, it might be years before you get your citizenship back. Now you know why I didn't miss that last aptitudes testing day. I try to imagine what Mom would do if the city showed up at the door to boot me out and my brain just shuts down. On that path lies madness. I shiver just thinking about it. Lo noticed. Cold? She asked. No, sorry, I said. Just thinking about something. I motioned toward the board. So, what now? Do I pick one of these jobs? Not quite, Lo said. I'm showing you all of these jobs so you have an idea of the scope of the city's need for labor. Okay, I get it, I said. Good, Lo said. Now, what I'm going to do next is plug in your aptitude test results into this matrix of job openings and see which ones they qualify you for. First, the results from your first day of testing, the recap of your knowledge from your education. Lo tapped her tablet screen. I watched as roughly 90% of the job openings disappeared from the wall. I spent the next minute or so opening and closing my mouth to no real good effect. I think there's something wrong with your wall display, I said finally.
The wall display is fine, Lo said. The problem is that overall you scored in the 35th percentile for your aptitudes. Look.
She held up her tablet display and showed it to me. My test scores were on a trio of lines, showing my ranking relative to others who had taken the test the same days I did, in the same year as I had, and since the beginning of the tests, just a few years after the founding of New St. Louis.
Actually, the 35th percentile is for the historical chart, Lo said, pointing. You scored lower among the people who took it with you, and who have taken it in the last year. And most of the people who did worse than you were people who were taking the aptitudes from outside the city.
Maybe there was a mistake in the scoring, I said.
Probably not, Lo said. The tests are triple scored by machine to catch errors. You're more likely to get hit by lightning than suffer an incorrect aptitude score.
I can take them again, I said.
You could have taken them again if you had taken them earlier, Lo said. But the next set of aptitudes isn't scheduled until after your 20th birthday, so for the purposes of your first job, you're stuck with these scores, Mr. Washington.
I slumped back into the chair. Mom was going to kill me. Lo looked at me curiously. I began to resent her, or at least what I figured she thought of me.
I'm not stupid, you know, I said.
You don't appear stupid, no, Lo said, agreeing. But I'd be willing to bet you didn't pay very close attention in school, and taking time off before you took your aptitudes certainly didn't help either.
Okay, that sounded exactly like something Mom would say. And like with Mom, I really didn't want to have that discussion right now. Fine, whatever, I said, and pointed at the wall.
So now I pick from these jobs?
Not yet, Lo said, because now I have to plug in the results from your second day of testing. The evaluator's reviews of your attitude and psychological fitness. The good news here is that a good score can put back on the board some of the jobs that you might have lost before. There are a lot of jobs that the city feels a motivated worker could do even if they don't have the academic aptitude test scores.
Okay, good, I said.
I felt slightly encouraged by that. I think I'm a pretty personable guy.
Here we go,
Lo said, and tapped her tablet again. All but three jobs disappeared from the board.
Oh, come on, I yelled. That can't be right.
Apparently it is, Lo said.
She gave her tablet to me. I took it and looked at it.
You scored even lower on the evaluator's reports than you did on the academic testing. It says there that you struck them as arrogant, bored, and defensive. One of them actually called you a bit of an asshole.
I looked up from the tablet for that one, appalled at what I was hearing.
You can't say that on an official report, I said.
They can say whatever they want, Lo said.
They're trained to evaluate everyone's fitness as an employee, and they're required by law to write their honest impressions. If one of them called you a bit of an asshole, it's because that's what you are, or at least what you come across as.
I'm not an asshole, I said, thrusting the tablet back at Lo.
Lo shrugged. You came in here with some attitude, didn't you? She said, taking the tablet. That joke about the monitor and your mom, for example?
I really did mean it as a joke, I said.
Maybe you did, Lo said. But it comes off like you're just dropping your mom's name to hint to me that you should be given a cushy job. Whether you mean it that way or not, that's how you present, and it is more than a little annoying. I can believe you came across as an asshole in your testing, and I can believe you probably weren't even aware of it at the time.
Can we talk about something else, please?
I said. This was not a good day so far.
Like, what jobs are available?
Okay, Lo said. She tapped her tablet. The three tiny squares remaining on the wall disappeared, replaced by three very large job listings.
The general feeling about you is that you're best off not working a job that requires any interaction with the public or that requires a great deal of technical competence, Lo said. So, basically, we're talking some form of back-end job with a heavy physical component. And among those types of jobs, we have three openings. Assistant greensperson at Park Tower Number 6, composting engineer trainee level at the East End Waste Transformation Plant, and biological systems interface manager at the Arnold Tower.
Composting engineer? I said, leaning forward in my seat.
That's what it says, Lo said.
It's a polite way of saying you'll be shoveling shit.
Although, as I'm sure you remember from your studies, there's more to industrial-scale composting than just shit.
I'm not doing that, I said, recoiling a bit.
Well, you have to do something, Lo said. If you hit your 20th without a job, you lose your citizenship, and not even your mom will be able to help you then.
I was beginning to get annoyed at her bringing up mom all the time.
Assistant greensperson doesn't sound so bad, I said.
That would be my choice, Lo said.
The park towers are nice. I go to the one down the street here on my lunch break sometimes. The greenskeepers are always tending to the trees and flower and bees. It's physical work, but at least you'll be in pretty surroundings. And remember, this is only your first job. If it's not to your liking, you can always get more training and education and try for a different sort of job. The important thing is you have a job.
Fine, I said. I'll take that one.
Good,
Lo said. We both looked up at the listing. It disappeared.
Whoops,
Lo said.
Whoops, I said. What whoops?
Lo accessed her tablet.
Looks like someone else just took the job.
It's gone.
That's totally not fair, I said. Other people are having their assignment sessions just like you are, Lo said. If you had taken the job first, someone else would be saying no fair right now. So now we're down to two jobs. Composting engineer trainee level and biological systems interface manager. Pick one. I suggest you pick quickly.
I looked up at the wall and my two remaining choices. Composting engineer just sounded vile. I wanted no part of it. I had no idea what biological systems interface management meant, but, you know, if it was management, that probably meant a good chance that I wouldn't be hunched over with a shovel or tiller in my hand, aerating solid waste and food scraps.
Mr. Washington,
Lo said.
Ah, who cares anyway, I thought. I'll talk to Mom about this and get it all sorted out.
Because while Mom was a hard ass about me taking a job, I was willing to bet there was almost no chance that Josephine Washington, executive council member, would let her only son spend any significant amount of time doing menial labor. She expected better of me, and I thought she'd help me live up to her expectations.
Biological Systems Interface Manager, I said.
Lo smiled. Excellent choice, she said, tapping her tablet and securing the job. I think you'll be perfect for it.
What is the job? I asked.
She told me, and then laughed when she saw the expression on my face.
So let's recap, Mom said to me at dinner. I'd explained my situation without quite telling her the job that I'd gotten.
You want me, a member of New St. Louis's executive board, a highly visible public servant, to pull strings for you so you can get a better job than the one you're qualified for. Come on, Mom, I said. You know I'm qualified for lots of jobs.
Do I? Mom said.
I know you didn't read your aptitude scores when they came in, Benji, but I did. I know what you got. I know you spent most of your education screwing off and screwing up because you didn't think any of it mattered. I told you to do better, but you were happy just to do well enough.
Oh, God, I thought.
Here we go again.
Look, Mom, said Cindy. Benji's got his I'm not listening anymore face on.
Shut up, Cindy, I said.
Well, you do, Cindy said.
Kiss ass, I said.
She was 16 and a model student and a little too smug about it for my taste.
Benjamin, Mom said.
Sorry, I said, shooting a look at Cindy. And anyway, Mom, I'm listening to you. Really.
Good, Mom said. Then you'll hear me fine this time. I'm not going to lift a finger to get you another job.
Why not?
I said. It came out more of a whine than I would have preferred. First off, because the last thing I need right now is for the news blogs to be talking about how I used my influence to get my son a job. Honestly now, Benji, you think people wouldn't notice? This isn't like me asking the school to switch your class schedule around, and you remember how much crap I got for that.
I looked at her blankly.
Or maybe you don't, Mom said.
I do, Cindy said.
Hush, Cindy, Mom said.
That was bad enough. Actually, yanking you out of the assignments queue and handing you a job you don't qualify for is the sort of thing that will get me kicked off the executive board.
It's an election year, Benji, and I've already got a fight on my hands because I'm for technology outreach. You know how many new Louis hate that idea?
I don't like it either, I said.
Technology outreach was a plan for NSL to help the people in the wilds by offering them some of the city's technology and support. It amounted to basically helping a bunch of people who had intentionally gone out of their way to fail in creating a sustainable civilization. I think it's a dumb idea.
Of course you do, Mum said acidly. You don't want us to share technology with the folks in the wilds, because then we wouldn't have something over them, and then you wouldn't be a precious little snowflake like all the other smug, precious little snowflakes in here. Keeping technology bottled up isn't why New St. Louis was founded. Quite the opposite, in fact. And these days, it's more important than ever. Cascadiopolis had the right idea. Develop useful technology, send it out into the world.
Look where it got Cascadiopolis, I said. It doesn't even exist anymore.
You spent too much time with those idiot cousins of yours in the Portland Arcology, Mrs. Washington said.
Whatever, Mom, I said. My cousins weren't idiots, even if they were snobbish enough that even I noticed it. I just don't see what it has to do with you helping me.
That's my point, Mom said. You don't appreciate what the consequences of me helping you like that would be. All you know is that you don't want the job you've been assigned. What job have you been assigned, anyway? Mrs. Washington reached for her iced tea.
I shrugged. No point keeping it from her now. Biological Systems Interface Manager at Arnold Tower, I said. Mom choked on her tea.
Mom, tea just came out of your nose, Cindy said.
I'm fine, baby,
Mom said, and reached down into her lap for her napkin.
See, I said accusingly, now you know why I want another job.
There's nothing wrong with the job, Mom said.
You just spit tea everywhere when I told you what it was, I said.
I was just a little surprised, is all, Mom said.
Come on, Mom, I said. There's got to be something else out there, something better than this, I said.
The job is fine, Mom said, and pounded her chest to get the remaining tea out of her lungs. In fact, I think the job will be great for you.
Well, great, I said, throwing up my hands. Just what I need, a learning experience.
That's right, Mom said. You do need a learning experience to get back to the list of reasons why I won't help you change your job. The second reason is that you need to understand the consequences of your choices, Benji, Mom said.
She dropped her napkin back into her lap.
Somewhere along the way you decided that you didn't need to work all that hard for things because you figured that I would always be there to bail you out and that my stature would help you get the things you wanted.
That's not true at all, I said.
Please, Benji, Mom said. I know you like to think it's not true, but you need to be honest with yourself. Think back on all the times you've asked for my help. Think back on all the times you've given just a little less effort to things because you knew I could back you up or put in a good word for you. If you're honest about it, you'll recognize you've relied on me a lot. I flashed back to Will in the pod, telling me how happy he was that I wasn't going to rely on my mom to get me through things. I shut my mouth and stared down at the table. It's not all your fault, Mom said gently. I've been always telling you to do things for yourself, but when it came down to it, I let you slide, and I bailed you out of a lot of things. But that has to change. You're an adult now, Benji. You need to be responsible for your